This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
This week on Radio EcoShock, three interviews with scientists on the cutting edge of climate change. From the UK, Chris Bolton hunts for signs of abrupt ecological shifts. From Norway, Hans Wehe explores the changing Arctic. But first, we look into whether air pollution is shading all of us from serious heating. Our guest, Professor Bjorn Stevens, is a director at the Max Planck Institute for Meteorology, where he leads the Atmosphere in the Earth System Department. He's also a professor at the University of Hamburg. Dr. Stevens was previously at the University of California in Los Angeles. Although born in Germany, he's an American citizen. He was educated in the United States. Bjorn Stevens is one of the world authorities on clouds and climate change. He's the lead author of a new paper on the limits of aerosol impacts on global warming, and that paper has already stirred up controversy, including among climate skeptics. Bjorn Stevens, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
The public knows so little about this scientific discussion, except when it's called global dimming. Is that an appropriate label?
Well, I'm not even sure people know that much about global dimming. There is this concept of global dimming and global brightening, which is normally associated with this regional pattern over Europe that happened in the 1950s and 1980s, where it seemed to be surface measurements of radiation were somewhat dimmed and then got brighter after the 1980s. And that's usually attributed to the atmospheric aerosol and human emissions of aerosols and aerosols precursors. Even that's a bit controversial to what extent that's due to aerosol processes. So when you speak about global dimming, it often gets convolved with this regional dimming and brightening. So it's even a bit unclear to me how much people really understand the aerosol issue, even when it's called global dimming.
Well, maybe we should back up a bit. What is an aerosol? How would you describe them?
Well, there's the formal definition. Formally, an aerosol is just a dispersion of one phase of matter in another. So an example would be, for instance, gas bubbles, gas phase suspended in liquid. So that would be an example of aerosol. When a wave breaks and you have lots of gas bubbles floating around in the water, that's an aerosol. Or if you have liquid phase suspended in the air, which is what a cloud is, that's also an aerosol. Or ice particles, which is a solid phase, that's also an aerosol. But usually, as atmospheric scientists, when we think of aerosols, we normally think of the non-water particulate matter suspended in the atmosphere, the very small submicron particles that are everywhere in the air. The atmosphere is full of particulates, and many of these are actually quite natural, as anyone who has seen a dust storm or tasted the salt in a sea breeze or sneezed in a field of hay can attest.
So you've entered into quite a debate with your new paper. Please tell us the title of the paper and give us an introduction as to why you did this study.
Well, the paper is called Rethinking the Lower Bound on Aerosol Radiative Forcing, and it arose out of an argument I had with some authors of a very influential study from the early 1990s, which I believe greatly overstated the magnitude of the aerosol forcing. So I was trying to convince them in a series of emails what I thought was flawed in their original reasoning. And at some point I thought, well, maybe it's just better to write these ideas down in a paper and then they can be evaluated as part of the normal scientific process. And the argument has something to do what I believe there's a long tradition of overstating the magnitude of aerosol forcing. And it's a very easy trap to fall into because if you look too narrowly at the subject, it's very easy to get lost in the details. And my paper was an attempt to step back a bit and explain why I think a large, at least in magnitude, aerosol radiative forcing really doesn't make physical sense.
And I'm told there are two approaches to calculating the cooling effect of human-made pollution. One is to try and add up all the known sources from factories to burning fields in Africa. You took quite a different approach, didn't you?
Yes, I did. Rather than trying to estimate the aerosol forcing directly in what one might call a bottom-up approach, where you try to go to the smallest scale and add up all the little pieces and how they interact and estimate the uncertainty, I focused more on not the aerosol forcing itself, but on the bounds and the extent to which a given bound is consistent with our broader understanding of the climate system. And by a bound, I mean the question is how big could the aerosol forcing be and still be consistent with other things we know about the climate system? A good example of a bound would be that if you had to make a physical measurement, say the diameter of a pipe, you might be uncertain in lots of things that you're doing, and you could estimate that uncertainty. And if you formally added up all that uncertainty, it's quite conceivable that you'd come up with an answer that says the pipe has a negative diameter, which of course makes no physical sense. So you know right away that the pipe has to, it exists, it has a diameter greater than zero. So that's an example of a bound. The diameter of the pipe has to be greater than zero. And for the aerosol forcing, I also focused on the bounds, and I said, well, how negative could an aerosol forcing be and still be consistent with the big picture? So this forced me to look at the big picture directly rather than trying to piece it together by through the details.
An important part of your paper, it seems to me, depends on estimating the impacts of pollution in the first half of the 20th century. How could you possibly know about pollution in the 1930s or 1940s, for example?
Yeah, the paper actually outlines several different lines of argument for why I think the aerosol forcing is less negative than often assumed. And one of those is, as you said, it's about the importance of pollution in the first half of the 20th century. I assume that the global aerosol effect is proportional to that associated with anthropogenic SO2 or sulfur dioxide emissions. When we account for fossil fuel use, which is reasonably well known over the past 100 or 200 years, we can get a pretty good handle on SO2 emissions because we know the sulfur content of fuels. There's a long tradition, actually, of scaling aerosol forcing with anthropogenic SO2 emissions. In fact, that very early study that I was arguing with, which got me into this topic to begin with, did the same thing. So I go a bit further, actually, and I show in my study that this tradition of saying that the total aerosol forcing is proportional to that, to the SO2 emissions, is actually well supported by the much more complicated calculations which try to add up the different sources that happen regionally and over time.
I realize this is a huge question, but can you say that there are important differences between pollution in this new century compared with the aerosols created in the 1900s?
Well, an important difference is that it's not changing nearly as rapidly as it was 100 years ago. So at the beginning of the industrial era, we had a really explosion of human-related aerosol emissions. So if you look in the early part of the 20th century and you look at how SO2 increased sulfur dioxide emissions, it was enormous. When you look globally, there's actually very little evidence that there's been much change in the net anthropogenic emissions of aerosols over the last 40 years. People get very excited about regional changes. So you see, for instance, as China has developed over the past 10 or 15 years, you've seen an enormous increase, and people have all seen the pictures of smog over China. There's been an enormous increase in terms of aerosol emissions or aerosol precursor emissions over China. But at the same time, what you've seen is declining emissions of SO2 as Europe and North America have desulfurized their fuels. So you've seen big regional changes over the last 40 years. But globally, the big difference is that the aerosol forcing was changing a lot at the beginning of last century and really hasn't been changing very much over the past 40 years.
I'd like to turn to the difficult subject of equilibrium climate sensitivity, or ECS. Bjorn Stevens, how can a non-scientist understand what this means?
Oh, it's actually a very simple idea, and that's its appeal. Maybe one analogy is to think of a pot of water on a camp stove. And imagine the water is not too hot, so it's not boiling, the flame's not too high. And, you know, if you have the flame really on a low temperature, then you'd be heating up the water, and it's kind of losing its heat to the air, so it's giving off steam. And it would kind of be at a constant temperature. If the flame's not too high, you might even be able to put your finger in the water without boiling it. Now, if you turn up the flame a little bit more, the water will get a bit hotter, and it'll keep going until it starts boiling. But in many ways, this question of, for a given increase in the flame, how hot does the water get, is very much the same idea of equilibrium climate sensitivity. For the pot of water, it might be better to think of, you know, what's the temperature of the water if you put the lid half on or three-quarters on or fully on, because, you know, if you put a little bit of heat in the bottom of the pot and you have the lid fully on, the water will be hotter than if you had the lid fully off. That would be a bit like the case of greenhouse gases. So climate sensitivity is really just the simple attempt to ask, if you increase the forcing, the heating of the planet, or decrease its ability to cool, how much warmer will it get? And formally, it comes to this question, we like to phrase it as equilibrium climate sensitivity. We like to think of a particular scenario that's especially easy. We say, just imagine you double the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere, how much warmer on average would the near surface air temperatures be? And that number is the equilibrium climate sensitivity.
Do we have an answer to that, a firm answer?
Well, we don't have the answer in the form of one number, like 4 or 4.2, but we have a range of values which have stood the test of time for what that number, what we think that number is. And it's a range that goes between 1.5 and 4.5 degrees Celsius. And a lot of the game over the last years has been to see if we can actually narrow the range in that estimate, because it's pretty broad.
So good. How does your work on the limits of aerosol forcing impact our understanding of climate sensitivity?
Well, it's a bit of a distance from my work to climate sensitivity, and they really come together, because if one attempts to estimate the climate sensitivity by the historical record of temperature changes and the historical record of radiative forcing, then the aerosol forcing is an important part of that calculation. And if you estimate things in that way, what my research would suggest is that the climate is a little bit less sensitive than it would have been if the aerosol forcing had been much larger in magnitude.
Why do you think climate skeptics and skeptical scientists like Nick Lewis and Judith Curry are among the first to write extensively about your new paper?
Well, I don't know. I find it a bit dangerous to speculate about people's motivations. And to be honest, I really don't pay much attention to the blogosphere. If anything, I make a conscious attempt to ignore it. I can understand why someone who is of the opinion that the public was overly alarmed by the risk of warmings might want to draw attention to my paper, because it's going to help you make one or the other argument. And likewise, if someone was of the opinion that the public is not sufficiently alarmed about the risks of warming, they might find undue attention on my paper as a bit counterproductive. But I don't know, as a scientist, I think we have an obligation to clearly state what we believe to be true, irrespective of how we perceive that might be used by others.
Does your view of a lower impact from aerosol pollution change the models and conclusions in the reports by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change?
Well, my work suggests that models are overstating the impact of the anthropogenic aerosol. And maybe that's not so surprising. Modeling the atmospheric aerosol is really fantastically difficult. It's loosely based on basic principles and not very well constrained by data. So I don't think anyone finds it surprising that attempts to model such a detailed life cycle of something as complex and as poorly understood as the aerosol could be off, and off by a large factor. I was part of the IPCC assessment, of the last assessment, the fifth assessment, and I think based on the information available at that time, the assessment was a reasonable one. My study brings new arguments to the table, and I would expect or hope that these will be reflected in the next assessment.
And you did give a talk at Ringberg last spring, which began with the title, "Some Not Yet Entirely Convincing Reasons Why This Is So." Does this suggest you think the question is still open for debate?
Let's see if I answer that properly. I think ECS, or equilibrium climate sensitivity, of less than 2 degrees is pretty hard to reconcile with what we know about the paleo record, or the behavior of the Earth through the course of ice ages, or even over longer time periods. And an equilibrium climate sensitivity over 3.5 is pretty hard to reconcile with the instrumental record. There's additional evidence that points to why an ECS, say less than 2 or greater than 3.5 or 4, should be seen as unlikely. But this is an ongoing argument. It's ongoing research, some of which is at the heart of the things we're doing here at my laboratory in Hamburg.
Some critics say you've dismissed the important role played by black carbon. What do you say about that?
Well, the issue certainly came up in the reviews of my paper. And black carbon, like many aspects of the aerosol, is often used as a joker, which allows people to play it any way that one finds convenient. So, for instance, colleagues have argued that I neglected the large increase in black carbon in the middle of the last century. So one of the arguments I actually gave was that the temperature increase in the middle of last century is hard to explain if you assume a large aerosol cooling. And they say, you forgot black carbon in the middle part of the last century. And then other colleagues come and they say, well, actually, the black carbon was all happening in the latter part of the century. There's many people who argue that black carbon is playing a disproportionate role in the forcing in the present period. So there's been people arguing that black carbon is contributing substantial warming to the climate in the present. Yet some of the same scientists then actually say that the lack of a surface warming signal in the past 15 years, or the modesty of the surface warming signal in the past 15 years, is because of the aerosol, and the implication being black carbon is not playing a role. So throughout all of this, I think it's important to realize that the aerosol is a very complex component of the climate system. And it's easy to think of reasons why, you know, it might be behaving in a particularly unusual way, which can explain this or that fact about the climate system. I tended to take a more conservative approach. And I think when you look at it from the aerosol point of view, the reality is that the aerosol forcing is, if it's important, it was far more important in the last century when CO2 wasn't playing such an important role. And I think as aerosol science matures, it will be increasingly apparent to people that to the extent we want to speculate about the role of the aerosol in future climate, the role of black carbon now, the role of it in the past, really depends on our ability to robustly demonstrate what was it about the 20th century that was different because we had such a large aerosol forcing. No one would dispute in the 20th century aerosol was a major player in the forcing of the climate system. In the 21st century, it won't be. CO2 keeps chugging away, more and more CO2. Aerosol hasn't really changed in 40 years. And so if you're looking for an aerosol signal, say from black carbon or from sulfate or from other components of the aerosol, the real place to look is in the 20th century, not in the 21st century.
And it seems your work began with a global picture, as you say, and global data. Is that not a limitation when it comes to determining the regional impacts of aerosol pollution in places like China or North India?
It depends a bit what you mean by regional impact. Certainly, it's a limitation if you're interested in regional health impacts. But if you're interested in the effect on global warming, the global signal, then the scientific question is the effect of the aerosol linear in the emissions? And if it's linear in the emissions, the global effect, then it's not a limitation of neglecting these sort of regional hotspots. And aerosol interactions with radiation are largely linear. That's the basis of most theoretical treatments of it. When you think about aerosol cloud interactions, those are nonlinear, and I accounted for these nonlinearities. Whether I do so adequately is something that we're presently testing in my laboratory. One aspect that I'm quite fond of in my study is that the assumptions I make are all very transparent and very testable, and I think that's really the key to advancing the science. In the end, it's less important to be right or wrong or to get the right number than it is to advance constructive scientific arguments and really have ideas that other people can check and follow up on. And when it comes to the pattern of aerosol forcing, I think my study was quite clear in how one can do that.
This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest from Hamburg, Germany, is atmospheric scientist Bjorn Stevens. We're discussing his new paper, Rethinking the Lower Bound on Aerosol Radiative Forcing, and what that means for us all. Now, the IPCC has acknowledged trying to calculate cloud activity is one of the most difficult problems of all. How does aerosol pollution interact with clouds? You'd mentioned that before. How does that affect the cooling or lack of cooling?
Well, the main effect is probably to make the clouds a bit brighter because the cloud droplets form on more particles, on an average are a bit smaller. It gives them a bit more surface area and they scatter more radiation. The next order effect we generally think is it makes the clouds mix a bit more efficiently so that they contain a bit less condensate. That tends to offset the other effect. And it's a bit of a lesson there as research over the past 30 years is really, I think, one of the things that's clearly come out of the research is that aerosol interactions with clouds happen in many, many different ways, but they happen in opposing ways. Many of them act to offset or buffer one another. Fundamentally, it's really important to remember that clouds form in response to atmospheric circulations, and the circulations are driven by the interaction of radiation with things like water vapor. And the role of the aerosol in explaining cloud formation is interesting, often fascinating, but really secondary.
Do you think there will ever be a cloud theory which could predict their behavior, a kind of solid theory of clouds?
Oh, I would say we already have some very compelling theories that have helped us understand a great deal about clouds. For the most part, we know the basic equations for clouds. When we do have uncertainties on the basic level, they come from a poor understanding of ice processes and difficulty in developing an aggregated view of clouds. So we have the basic equations to describe clouds, modulo some understanding of ice processes. We have a real difficult time when it talks about the aggregated behavior of the clouds, if you like, the sociology of clouds. But here I see a lot of prospects for a bright future for cloud and water vapor research, both because of the capacity we have for field measurements, advances in satellite remote sensing of clouds, especially three-dimensionally. There's a range of satellite sensors that can probe through the depth of the atmosphere and tell you a lot about the morphology of clouds and their placement through the vertical depth of the atmosphere. And advances in computing allow us to use the basic equations, which we know reasonably well and understand, to explore what I was calling this sociology of clouds, the aggregated behavior of fields of clouds. So I'm quite optimistic that we can begin bringing together a lot of the fairly well-developed theoretical ideas we have of clouds into a more consistent global picture.
From my perspective, Bjorn, if your research results become widely accepted and proven true, this could be good news. I say that because many of us, including scientists like James Lovelock and James Hansen, feared that cleaning up air pollution could unleash warming rather quickly, almost like a climate punch. But maybe we have less to worry about if we clean up.
Yeah, indeed. I've been saying for a while we have nothing to fear from clean air.
Right, and we could possibly save millions of lives if we can do it. So is there a test that would vindicate your assessment that aerosol forcing may be much lower than we thought, or do you think it's already proven?
Well, mathematicians and lawyers are probably the only class of individuals that prove things. Scientists develop narratives, and we argue about them. And at some point, the arguments become so convincing that in the absence of new information, we spend our time arguing about other things. So, for instance, we don't spend much time arguing about evolution anymore, or we don't really worry about whether or not the sun's at the center of the solar system. And I think most scientists really don't argue very much about whether increasing level of CO2 are due to humans and whether or not that causes warming. And so at most I can hope we'll spend a little less time arguing about the importance of the atmospheric aerosol. But that may take some time.
You know, I'm struggling to picture how we could move this important discussion out of the scientific conference halls and journals and into the public mind. Do you have ideas how we could frame this debate so that anyone with a high school education could understand it, or is it too soon for that?
I'm not sure. I think regardless of how one looks at the debate, it's very important to understand that the question of aerosol forcing is really a question of, as I said before, it's a question of the 20th century, not the 21st century. When thinking about research priorities for the 21st century, what's changing and what's happening is that the Earth is warming and CO2 concentrations are increasing. And we don't really understand what that means in some detail. We know that the Earth's going to get warmer, but with a warmer world, do the rain bands shift? Do the storms intensify? These are the sorts of questions which I think we increasingly need to focus on. And we need to think about how we can measure the changes that are happening to the Earth system as we go through this unprecedented change in the composition of the atmosphere, as we increase the amount of CO2, as the Earth warms. Are we measuring the flows of energy through the system adequately? And the answer is no. Are we keeping track of the ocean's heat content adequately? And the answer is probably no. And are we keeping our eye on the prize in terms of what is the distribution of clouds and water vapor in the atmosphere, and the structure of circulation systems, which we're arguing may be changing? And there's a real danger that rather than looking at these basic fundamental aspects of the Earth system as it warms, we'll turn ourselves to an ever more detailed view, what I would call an embroidery of the climate system, because those are new and interesting and fascinating things, but they're probably not the most important things.
So you would say that aerosols are perhaps not what leaders at the Paris Climate Talk should be talking about?
Well, certainly, cleaning up the aerosol is hugely important for human health, and they shouldn't worry about cleaning up the air. So I would hope that would be the simplest of things that they could do, because I really see very little repercussion from cleaning up the air in terms of the global climate system, and huge benefits, as far as I understand it, are likely to follow for human health. So maybe that's one thing they should be talking about in that sense. They should, of course, be talking about CO2, because every molecule of CO2 we don't emit today does, I like to say, 1,000 years of good. Another thing that they should be talking about is that as we try to adapt, which we'll have to do in part, regardless of how much we mitigate against CO2 emissions, how we adapt is far more a question of basic research than most policymakers, and I would venture even scientists, appreciate. Forsaking the basic science, or trying to tie it too closely to the perceived needs of the policy communities is, I would say, grossly negligent of future generations, because the climate's changing. And one thing we know is we're going to have surprises. And the best way to prepare society for surprises is to give scientists the creative potential to think about the things that they wouldn't ordinarily think about if they were following the short-term needs of the policy community. And that's what you call curiosity-driven or basic research. And I think we're not leaving enough space for that in climate science.
As we finish up, Bjorn, is there anything else you would like to leave with our listeners?
Well, I would like to say science is fun. It's great fun. There's huge challenges facing climate sciences. And most of these are related to understanding how the atmospheric circulation will respond to warming. I think we should stop. Well, most of us actually have stopped posing the question as to whether the Earth will warm because of increasing CO2. The real question is what happens when it warms. So we've spent most of the last 40 years asking whether the Earth will warm and to what extent humans are responsible. We know the answers. The answer is yes and yes. So the real interesting and fun questions scientifically are how Earth's circulation systems respond to this warming. And the more we look at it, the more we appreciate that clouds are at the heart of this puzzle. So it's a great time to be interested in clouds and circulation and atmospheric science.
We've been talking with the director of the prestigious Max Planck Institute for Meteorology in Hamburg, Germany, Bjorn Stevens. Dr. Stevens, it's been an honor to have you on Radio EcoShock. Thank you so much.
Yeah, it was my pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio. For the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. When a scientist starts talking about abrupt ecosystem change, as the title of a new paper does, that really gets my attention. This time it's the ocean, and specifically the North Pacific Ocean, which borders some of the most heavily populated places on Earth. The title is Slowing Down of the North Pacific Climate Variability and Its Implications for Abrupt Ecosystem Change. From the College of Life and Environmental Sciences at the University of Exeter in the UK, we've reached the lead author, Dr. Chris A. Bolton. Chris Bolton, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
We'll have to talk about some science that may be new to listeners, but before we begin, will the changes happening in the ocean really affect human lives?
Well, I think so. I think one of the main things that we're going to experience and everyone will see quite clearly is a rise in sea level with climate change. And obviously that's going to affect lots of people that live on the coast. They'll lose their homes and things. We'll lose beaches. And obviously that's going to affect local economies as well. But also things that we might not see or notice as well is that the warmer oceans will tend to have a different interaction with the atmosphere above it, and that's going to change weather patterns as well. I think some people have noticed that we're starting to see less cyclones, but that they're going to be more intense. And then also there's other things such as current changes, so changes in the ocean currents. That's probably going to take a bit longer to notice, but again, that's going to change weather patterns even more. So there's lots of things going on that are going to affect people.
So what drove you and your colleague Tim Lenton to do this research?
So we work on studying what are called climate tipping points. So these are these large, drastic, sudden changes that we see in climate systems, and we try to predict them. We try to think of techniques that will give people some early warning that we're approaching them. And if we want to look for these in the real world, then we need real-world data, and sea surface temperatures are some of the longest monitored time series that we have out there, so it's a natural place to look for these sort of signals. And we were just sort of exploring, and we came across quite a strong signal that's similar to these slowing down signals that happened in the North Pacific. And also looking at something called the PDO index, which I expect we'll get onto in a minute, that also showed the same signal. So.
Right. So what is the Pacific Decadal Oscillation that you've just referred to?
Right. So the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, or the PDO index, as we call it, is a mode of climate variability. And that basically tells us how the ocean's varying over time on like a grid point by grid point scale. So if we look at all the temperatures in the ocean at different points, we can see that over the last century it's generally been warming. And we also know there's some annual cycle in there, so it's going to be colder in winter, warmer in summer. But then if we want to then know what the what's causing the variability in the ocean, we get to what's called the PDO index. And that's basically a playoff between the ocean temperatures that are on the west coast of the Pacific Ocean and moving towards the center, so like a blob that goes from Japan to the center, and then also like a horseshoe shape that goes around the north and down the west coast of America. And that basically, this horseshoe shape will be warmer than the blob in some cases, in some years, and in other years that will switch over, and that gives us our oscillation. So it's just like a description of what the ocean's doing once we take out that general warming trend and we account for the fact that we have some annual variability in there.
Is it true this ocean pattern was discovered in part due to observations made about salmon runs?
Yeah, so Stephen Hare from Washington, I think in the late 90s, was looking at how salmon productivity or salmon catches were affected by climate change. And when he looked in all the ocean temperatures, he made some connection between this PDO index that he discovered and the catches of salmon in different areas. So, yeah, there's a connection there.
Now, what I find a little harder to understand is what is the relationship or difference between this Pacific decadal oscillation we've been talking about and ENSO, the better-known cycle that brings us an El Niño or La Niña?
Yeah, sure. So you could say that the Pacific decadal oscillation is like the ENSO's northern cousin, I suppose. So there's a bit of an extension of them. They kind of play off each other, but I guess the Pacific decadal oscillation works on longer time scales, so it will be like, say, 20 or 30 years in one state before it switches over, whereas the ENSO oscillations tend to work on much smaller time scales, but that they can amplify each other's effects, basically. So if the PDO is in a certain phase when ENSO is, then you'll see some amplification as there's a bit of an overlap, and likewise, their effects will be dampened if they're in different phases.
Reading over your paper, I find that scientists use the term redder in the context of this study to mean something different than just the color. What do you mean by that?
Sure. So I like to use an analogy of a ball in a well or a valley. So basically, if your ball's stuck in like a really narrow valley and you pushed it around, it would quickly roll back to the bottom again. And that's something that we'd call white noise. So that's a bit like the static you'd get on a television, for example. But when something's getting redder, it's basically saying that this valley is shallowing and getting wider. And so then when the ball gets pushed, it tends to move slower and it will take longer to recover back to the middle. So I guess it's a bit like someone talking really deeply on a sound wave, and you start to see like a long drawn out wave as opposed to like this sort of high frequency noise that you might expect when you're recording something, some static off a television, for example. So it's kind of like a change in that wavelength, I suppose you could call it.
All right. Now, you do talk about higher amplitude but lower frequency events. Are you saying the North Pacific may change less often, but when it does, it may change radically?
Yeah. So if you look at this PDO index, for example, we've seen the changes in 1977 and 89, but we haven't noticed those so much towards the early century. And so that's kind of showing you that as you go over time, you're starting to see these more pronounced events that have happened, and they seem to be more abrupt as well. So, yeah, as we're having this more redder system, you start to see more extreme changes that you might not have noticed before, because you have this more white static sort of noise rather than the person talking deep into the microphone, I guess.
What did happen in 1977 and 1989 that was so noticeable?
So going back to Stephen Hare's research, I guess she's seen that the salmon productivity in different areas changed. So in Alaska, for example, I apologize, I can't remember which way around they go exactly, but in Alaska you might have seen salmon catches quite high there, and then when it got to 1977, they might have all disappeared, but you might have got more salmon found like further down the west coast, for example. And that was due to this change in the PDO index. As I said earlier, we had this blob and horseshoe sort of pattern. So before 1977, for example, the horseshoe would have been cooler than the blob in the middle, but then they would have changed over, so you would have had a warmer horseshoe compared to the blob, and then in 1989 that they would have changed back again. So you get a change in the sign of the PDO index, I guess.
Chris Bolton, what do scientists expect will happen to ocean mixing as the Earth warms?
These sort of ocean mixing things, I think, are quite poorly modelled, but I think the general idea is that as you warm the ocean temperatures, you start to see less mixing, and particularly between the top layer of the ocean and what's happening underneath.
Well, Dr. James Lovelock warned that the oceans could become stratified with climate change, with less oxygen mixing in and possibly more dead zones developing. Do you believe that will happen with global warming, and what time frame would we be talking about?
Sure. So I think most of the drivers of dead zones happen from chemical runoff from cities, and they get into the ocean and cause these dead zones. But I think that warming temperatures also amplify that effect. And so what happens is that you see more stratification, so there's less mixing between the top layer of the ocean and what happens underneath. And so what happens is the oxygen doesn't get to what's happening below, and so everything kind of gets sealed off and suffocates, I guess. But there's also the problem that warmer water holds less oxygen anyway, so you're having like a double effect there. So.
That's interesting. So if the mixed layer depth decreases, how will that affect the general reduction of the ocean variability that we've seen in the last century?
Yeah, so this is a bit of a tough question for me. So if the mixed layer depth decreases, that potentially reverses the signal that we found of this less variability. That's an interesting thing that we need to look into a bit more. So it firstly depends on how much the mixed layer depth is actually driving this variability that we've seen. And we think that the mixed layer depth explains our signal in part, but not fully. So that needs a bit more research in the context of our study.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Dr. Chris Bolton from the University of Exeter in England. We're talking about surprises in the way oceans work. Chris, your work is part of a large body of scientific research coming out lately that suggests large-scale and relatively rapid environmental changes are not only possible, but more likely as we continue to destabilize the climate. What could you envision happening in the North Pacific Ocean, and how quickly could it occur?
So I guess this is talking about the tipping points that we study. Well, when we found the signal in the North Pacific, we were wondering whether we were actually seeing an approach towards a tipping point. But we couldn't actually see any evidence of like true tipping point behavior, as people generally think of what tipping points are. So we think that the system, like the PDO index, for example, if the signals we see are going to continue, then we'll start to see more rapid and stronger like changes between like these salmon productivity regimes, for example. But then they might change again afterwards. So I don't think you'll see anything drastic that can't be reversed, and it will eventually just switch back in between the two, but they'll become a lot more drastic than they have been over the last century.
Well, I want to get back to that tipping point idea, but first I've got a couple of general questions that may be in the minds of my listeners. For example, in 2015, we've seen an unusual blob, as they've called it, of hot water parked off the Pacific coast of North America. A very scientific term, blob.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, definitely a scientist. Made that up.
Well, it's affected the weather in the western states and Canada, possibly adding to the big drought here. Do you know, does anybody know why it's there?
So I had to look up a bit about North Pacific things recently, and I saw this blob, and it appears to be near the horseshoe shape that I was talking about earlier. So that's interesting because it might fit in with this PDO index and shown that it's in like the stronger warming phase than it has been before. I don't exactly know why it's here. I might put it down to sort of natural variability. So, you know, it might just be, oh, it's raining today, for example, but on a much larger time scale. But I think it does kind of highlight the importance that these sort of regimes have. So the fact that the ocean temperatures do have such an effect on the, like, the droughts that you see. So it's important to study these sort of things.
So in contrast to what's happening in the North Pacific, NASA says Greenland ice is melting faster than previously thought and may have created a cold blob, if we want to call it that, of water. in the North Atlantic. There's far less ice to melt in the North Pacific. I wonder whether the Pacific will warm faster than the Atlantic just because of that factor.
Well, that's certainly an idea. And the fact that we're seeing the cold bubble water in the North Atlantic could tell you that on the short time scale, you might see faster warming in the Pacific. But the interesting thing about the Greenland ice sheet melting is that people worry that this will actually create a tipping point of something called Atlantic meridional overturning circulation collapse. And that will cause a huge reduction in temperature over the North Atlantic. Some people even suggest that it could cool North Europe up to 10 degrees. But, I mean, that's very drastic, and it's not likely to happen for hundreds of years, I hope. But, as well as just not warming as much, then the currents in the Atlantic might be changed drastically as well by this ice melt, because you're dumping fresh water into the ocean as opposed to saltier water that's already there, and that affects the currents as well.
Well, getting back to the North Pacific, many of my listeners are concerned about a couple of ocean changes that they see on the shoreline. We've got fishermen and surfers finding tropical species of fish further north than usual, and at the same time, I'm seeing more news reports of mass die-offs, everything from whales to starfish. Chris Bolton, is there anything strange happening in the North Pacific that you know about that could explain this?
So I wouldn't exactly say strange, but obviously the warmer temperatures are going to mean that fish, they're going to be happier in a certain temperature for range, and that temperature range is going to be getting more poleward, so they're going to be migrating north, so they feel comfortable. I know that one of the mass die-offs was down to a disease. I think that killed lots of starfish, and it could be that the virus that did this could be cultivated better in these warmer temperatures in that position. So going off on a bit of a tangent, I know that there's similar worry for crops that they grow in Africa, for example, that these sort of diseases could be cultivated in different temperatures and different places. And so that could be a similar thing happening in the North Pacific. So, yeah, obviously, if these sort of things happen, these diseases, then they're going to have a knock-on effect and cause other mass die-outs as well, because of the lack of food for other ecosystems. That's one explanation, anyway.
Good enough. Well, touching on the tipping points that you raised earlier, I'm wondering if we experienced an abrupt ecosystem change in the ocean, as your paper describes, would we know what was happening during the event or only after the fact?
So what happens is you have these indexes like the PDA, for example, and because it varies quite a lot, you need to be sure that you're in that regime before you can say that you're in that regime. So you might have like an anomalous year, for example, that just drops you into the other regime, but then it will shift back like the year after. And so I think these type of regime shifts need to be established, and you need to make sure you're in them beforehand, before you start looking afterwards. So we probably only know about them after the fact. But also, if they're going to affect salmon productivity and things like that, then they're not going to happen instantly. You're going to have like the life cycle of the salmon before you know that you haven't had as high productivity. So that might take a couple of years to realize after that.
Well, it sort of worries me in your paper, because it seems to suggest everything may seem normal in the ocean for many years, and then rather quickly and perhaps with little notice, the Pacific ecosystem could suffer a big change. Should we worry about this?
So I guess if you're a local fisherman, you might be worried about those sorts of things, because everything might be happy for a couple of years and then suddenly you've got no fish. But I think from a more global sort of tipping point of view, then it's going to shift back eventually afterwards. So it's not something that's irreversible. And from a general viewpoint, you shouldn't worry that the climate's like been destroyed, if you want to call it that, because it will come back to the other phase eventually and then shift back again. It's just something that randomly switches backwards and forwards. So
would it do us any good to know that this shift is coming, or is the Pacific such a giant system there's not much we can do about it anyway?
So if we could predict it, it's always good, because in the best case scenario, if you wanted to keep you want to keep the system in that regime, then you want to mitigate whatever's making it change. if you know about it beforehand and you can't do anything about it, you can at least prepare for it. So, yeah, even if you can't do anything about it, you can prepare yourself for the change if you need to, if you know about it beforehand.
Well, you've talked about bigger events happening, but with less frequency, and I find an intriguing connection with another paper that I found. It was published in PNAS in 2008 by Vasilis Dakos et al., and the title says it, Slowing Down as an Early Warning Signal for Abrupt Climate Change. Would you agree there's a parallel between what you found in the North Pacific and the general idea that systems may slow down before they change in a big way?
Yeah, definitely. Our methods are actually based on the methods in this paper. My co-author Tim has done quite a lot of work with Vasilis and his team, so we kind of use similar signals. And in fact, when we were originally looking for this signal, we were trying to look for this tipping point behavior or this abrupt climate change that Vasilis talks about in our time series. So we were actually looking for a similar thing in the first place, but we can't actually give any evidence that a tipping point in the same sense is going to occur in the North Pacific, and it's more like you'll just get this oscillation that goes backwards and forwards. But the fact that we use the same methods, yeah, there's definitely a parallel there.
It's kind of a scary idea for me, Chris, because, you know, humans, we take current conditions for granted. I don't check my wiring in my house or my plumbing. I just wait till something breaks, and then I think I'll fix it, you know. Nature could seem very stable just before it shifts into a different state.
Yeah, definitely. I mentioned earlier this AMOC collapse that might just happen suddenly and you'd have 10 degrees cooling in North Europe, supposedly. I mean, that's a huge change that would happen pretty abruptly compared to how stable it's been beforehand.
Well, you can come and stay at my house, Chris, if it gets too cold there.
Oh, thank you, yeah. It's quite cold there as well, right?
well, not too bad, actually. I'm in the hottest part of Canada, practically. So what will you be working on next?
We've got a master's student who's been working with us, and they've been looking at the salmon time series, for example, whereas in our paper we've just made like simple toy models, if you want to call it, of ecosystems. And so working with them, it might be nice to try and make a connection between like actually modelling the salmon and seeing what effect our research would have on that. But otherwise, I'm going to look a bit more into these early warning signals, so using the similar methods that we've been talking about here to try and predict tipping points in other systems.
We've been talking with Dr. Chris Bolton. He's a scientist with the College of Life and Environmental Sciences at the University of Exeter in England. Chris and Tim Lenton just published a paper titled Slowing Down of the North Pacific Climate Variability and Its Implications for Abrupt Ecosystem Change. Chris, thank you for this voyage into the inner workings of the North Pacific.
Thank you for having me. It's been good fun.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. You can find more links for this discussion in my weekly show blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.info.
Radio EcoShock.
Scientists measure disappearing Arctic sea ice from space. Our next guest travels there to learn from the land and the local culture. We just have time for a brief interview with Hans-Jørgen Wallenwehe. He's a professor at Lillehammer University College in Norway. What northern lands have you visited?
I have been traveling circumpolar. I've been in Siberia and the northern part of the Nordic countries, and in Greenland and in northern part of Canada.
And why did you go there?
Well, partly I went there because I was interested in the changes which are happening in the high Arctic, going from a hunting economy into a modern economy, and partly because of the environmental change in the high Arctic.
Well, many of us here think of a land of snow and ice as forbidding, maybe as a death place for famous explorers like Franklin. But for the people who live there, snow and ice are like a language, and you've done a study of Aboriginal languages from the Canadian North, Greenland, and Scandinavia. What sorts of things did you find in the languages of frozen lands?
In a way, I mean, the language connected to the landscape tells a lot about the culture of the high Arctic people and how they use the ice and snow environment. It's used for hunting, for reindeer herding, and of course also for navigating.
And this language of what has always been known, as the Inuit say, how could that help us to understand how the polar climate is changing?
The language is very connected to the situation of the past, and it's reading the changes in the environment and the changes in cracks in the ice and the changes in snow structure and so on. Tells a lot about this climate change. And of course, it also tells a lot about the high, long transported pollution from the south.
Is the color of the snow changing, for example?
Sometimes it is changing. And sometimes there are very, very drastic changes in the high Arctic due to pollution from the far south.
All right. And do you think that modern scientists are drawing on this Inuit knowledge to understand the things like changes to sea ice?
In many ways, I feel like the traditional language and the traditional knowledge of the local people have to a great extent been ignored. We are mostly reading changes through the use of high technology and through different kind of analyses done by satellites and, of course, also by field work. But we are not, to a great extent, listening to the local people and their knowledge of the past.
If a common language is established in one region, say in Greenland, would that undermine the survival skills that are hidden within each dialect?
I think so. I think language is mostly very, very local. It's connected to the very local environment. And it gives a lot of insights into the local environment. And when we lose that language, we lose part of the connection to the landscape, in my opinion.
And it seems to me, Hans, that globalization is sweeping away local cultures even faster than the imperial empires before it. What do you think happens when Netflix and Disney and Facebook connect up people in the far north?
Well, I think in a way that the use of modern technology can be combined with traditional local knowledge. But very often that does not happen. And to forget the local knowledge and ignore it, living more modern life. But those people who really succeed in the high Arctic, they, like a lot of them, have quite some, they also use the local language and the local knowledge, and that is also connected to their foundational values.
Do you think young Greenlanders are tuned into climate change? Would they take part in activities trying to save the polar ice, or might they welcome a warmer climate?
I think many of them will connect to everything that can preserve their environment. But of course, you have the others also as well.
And what do you think about the situation of Aboriginal people, say, in Norway or Sweden, compared to Canada?
Well, I think in the Rio of Nunavut in northern Canada, the independent Inuit territory, I think it's a very, very strong sense of identity connected to the environment. And I also do think that that's the same thing is true in the Sami Reefs in northern Norway and the traditional Norse Reefs in the northern Norway and Siberia. However, I mean, new groups of population are moving into those areas to a great extent. And often the traditional population is a small minority.
Yes, and I expect to see even more of that as the possibilities of oil and gas developing in the Arctic come along.
I do so too. But still, I think also even oil and gas companies, they will need that kind of knowledge in order to understand the environment and the environmental changes in the high Arctic.
You know, Hans, we've had scientists on this program worrying about thawing permafrost. How is that actually experienced in northern lands?
Well, the change in permafrost is very, very serious. Of course, for all structures built on the permafrost, the ground is not as stable as before. You get more mudslides and so on. So you get it hot, and the landscape is deteriorating in different ways. Rivers are digging away, and so on.
Are there other signs of climate change in the far north that you could tell us about?
Well, I mean, it's not all. It's also about the ice itself. The ice is generally thinner than before.
It's more difficult to travel on the ice. The ice is currents are making a reef where you formerly could travel very safely, very unsafe to travel on. You see the changes in the vegetation, you see the changes in the animal population, you see it everywhere.
Now, as you know, Shell Oil has received most of the permission it needs to drill in the Arctic off Alaska, and we know Greenpeace protested a drilling rig off Greenland. Do you think Aboriginal governments will welcome this new oil revenue, or do they realize it will further destabilize the polar climate?
I'm afraid some Aboriginal will also welcome the oil exploration because of the income. But I think many people will object to the oil drilling because it might deteriorate the environment.
All sorts of countries claim an interest in the Arctic. Denmark is competing with Canada. Russia wants to claim a huge area. Even China wants a seat on the Arctic Council. What do you think of this modern rush to own the Arctic?
The modern rush to own the Arctic means that there are serious economical interests in the sea bottom, or underneath the sea bottom, actually. It's for fishing, it's for oil exploration, it's for different kind of mining on the bottom of the sea floor, and so on. It tells a lot about the future conflicts and the future potential environmental challenges we are facing.
Are you concerned about increasing release in the Arctic of the dangerous greenhouse gas methane?
Absolutely. We are all very, very scared about that.
And what do you think about proposals to geoengineer to slow down the melting of glaciers and sea ice, for example, spraying sulfur particles in the Arctic air?
Well, personally, I feel like all kind of chemical or human interference in processes like that, except by stopping our own release of into the atmosphere, is something that can have negative impacts as well.
In your opinion, Hans, should the culture of what has always been known be protected, and can it be protected?
It should at least be acknowledged, and we should give priority. We should be able to listen to people who have lived in the Arctic, and we should try to use their knowledge as part of our attempts to protect the environment. And that's not only for the Arctic. It's also about Pacific cultures. It's also about all kind of rural culture and the knowledge. It's very, very important wherever it is.
We've been talking with Hans-Jørgen Wallenwehe, a professor at Lillehammer University College in Norway. He's written about Greenland and about the language and culture of peoples around the Arctic Circle and what that can tell us about climate change. That's it for Radio EcoShock. Join us next week as the world turns. I'm Alex Smith, saying thank you for listening.